approval of the minutes from March and April. Everybody get a chance to review those? Anybody recognize any changes that the corrections?
Mike. I'm looking for it now. I'd seen a comment where in the minutes where it said 7-inch mesh net was not readily available.
Okay.
Is that? And I can't find where it says that.
Seems I read that in the minutes when I reviewed them. But we'll make sure it's in there.
Because it's not, it's incorrect. 7-inch mesh is completely readily available.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, that's the primary nets used by watermen in the Potomac and Maryland.
Okay. All right, we'll make sure that's in there. Any other changes? Motion to approve both.
Well, wait, excuse me, point of order. If he's wanting to see the comments on the 7-inch mesh, why would we approve it if it's not here?
Well, we're going to put those in. We have a suggestion to include those. Tom?
Well, I think he's, but the point is, and make sure I heard what you said properly. What you said was there was a statement made that it was hard to get a 7-inch mesh net. In fact, it is not difficult to get them. It's not in the written minutes, at least what I just skimmed through and read. So the written minutes, as written, are fine. There is a question about what was in the recorded verbatim minutes.
Are you okay with these?
That I think just was corrected.
Okay.
You are recorded. Okay. Good evening, everyone. You are recorded, so it's part of the record. The minutes are not verbatim. They never are. But the minutes are a lot better than a lot of the minutes that I've seen over the years. So staff does a pretty good job. There is some context for the 7-inch mesh at the end of the minutes. But the correction is noted. It can be changed online for the online minutes. But the minutes are an interesting situation. You know, for years we always thought that if you didn't have a quorum, you didn't approve the minutes. Until we had a lawyer who was on our staff for a while, and he said, no, all that has to happen is the chair has to say approval of the minutes, and they're approved, whether or not there was a quorum or not. So we're constantly learning, but we're covered on taking care of that reference to the 7-inch mesh. That'll be done on the online version. And then I have some other things to talk about, but it looks like someone else.
But I think what he just said is if you do put that correction in the online minutes, you might put a parenthetic behind it that at the following meeting it was pointed out that they are readily available.
Duly noted. Alexis got that.
If that's acceptable to everybody. Do we have a motion to approve?
I'll motion.
All right, second. Any opposed? Seeing none, the minutes are approved.
Okay, so may I
please
say a couple things? So one thing is that what we sent out to you, we have added under new business to get an update on cobia management and the Virginia fishery. And this is something that Pat will go over. It has several different components to it. Needless to say, cobia fever is all around us, and Pat will explain why maybe as we go down the road a little bit, we want to, you know, quell that fever a little bit for the benefit of what happens after our three-year stint is up with the ASMSC. So Pat's going to go over that on new business. Tonight we have James Holloway, and he'll be first up speaking on behalf of the nomination of the Yorktown Shipwreck Area as a marine sanctuary. This is eventually done by NOAA. So you may have seen something in the press, some of you, about Mallows Bay and are familiar with that process, which I just found out today the governor of Maryland decided that he would promote that forward. So, you know, that's been a sticky issue up in Maryland. But this is something that we think the Shellfish Management Committee will also like to hear about the Marine Sanctuary proposal. And it is just a proposal. Mr. Holloway and John Broadwater, who's here, who's a underwater archaeologist who's been diving in that area. They certainly are the experts, but they'll provide that information and get any questions or comments from you. Striped bass were in meeting four, and it's all part of a leading up to the August meeting of the ASMFC in early August, and then we'll find out exactly what they're asking for. We know what they're asking for, but they'll have to decide which types of measures they really want. So Alex has been working hard on this with the help from a few others for several months. The benefit of tonight is before, when we made presentations to you, especially the recreational fishery, we didn't have anything that came close to, you know, 17% reduction from 2017, which was the charge from ASMFC. That's changed a little bit. Alex will explain that when he gets up here as to what the reduction is now, but our goal tonight in putting something together for everyone is to have proposals that will meet the required recreational reduction, and you will be able to comment as to what else you would like to see either within those proposals, or if you have a proposal, you know, that's fine too. But frankly, we've gone through probably 10 different proposals since we started meeting. I'll state again that the commercial fishery is a difficult task. It's a difficult task because there's an ITQ. Matter of fact, there's a individual weight transferable quota. So it's not like the recreational fishery. And we were hoping that we could use such things as maybe a maximum size, maybe a mesh size, maybe have a combination, and instead of looking at a fish reduction, number of fish either harvested or dead discards, that we could have alternate proposals that would say, if we do this, then the commercial fishery will be able to show that the change in spawning potential or fishing mortality rate is going to be equivalent to a quota reduction. But that's been thrown off the table. Anything other than the commercial fishery right now, quite frankly, is difficult to see other than a quota reduction. You know, that's, we had tries, we had hopes. You may remember Pat showed you different mesh sizes and how they might be able to provide some help somewhere. But even the dead discards aren't much help in the commercial fishery because the entire bay for the commercial fishery was 2% for the dead discards. That includes Maryland and PRFC. You know, part of the reason is to get at the dead discards through a tag system where they make the comparison to what the recreational tags are and then make assumptions about what the commercial tags are is not is exactly as great an effort as just doing harvest by itself. On the recreational side, you have to live with MRIP. MRIP's been advanced. It's been modified as of July 1, 2018, approaching a year. It's starting to get used in all the stock assessments. It's already been used in the striped bass and summer flounder stock assessments. So there are these changes that you know, you would hope, and it should be, that it's going to take a little while for them to settle down. So a lot going on in the fisheries world, not just here, but in other places as well. So I hope you'll listen carefully to this proposal on the marine sanctuary, and any questions you have would be really good, or comments. So, and I just met Mr. Holloway, so he's going to come up and give your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Good evening.
Welcome, Mr. Holloway.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. And my colleague, John Broadwater, has a few handouts to share. And I'm here representing a committee of residents of York County, Gloucester County. I'm a former resident of Gloucester County. I live in Alexandria now. And we have been working on a nomination form for a section of the York River as a National Marine Sanctuary, and I thought I'd talk very briefly about that section, very briefly about the process that we're in, and what our goals are, what we're not trying to do as well, and then we really want to hear any questions or concerns and try to address those as well. The site we're looking at is in the York River between Yorktown and Gloucester Point, where a number of shipwrecks are located, approximately 26 Revolutionary War shipwrecks. Most of them are ships that Lord Cornwallis scuttled during the siege of Yorktown, and a couple of ships that were sunk during the battle that weren't scuttled as well. And several have been discovered. One has been excavated back in the 1980s. The State Archaeology Department did some excavations on the Betsy. John Broadwater led that excavation, and artifacts from that are in Richmond at the Department of Historic Resources, and some are on display in Yorktown at the American Revolution Museum at Yorktown. And this sanctuary would provide an opportunity for further study, for preservation, and for educational opportunities, and that's really the focus. We're looking primarily at exploring the wrecks further, learning more from them, finding additional wrecks if possible, and then disseminating that information in a variety of possible ways that would be possible by a sanctuary. We're not interested in restricting access to the space. We've actually looked at the space, which is currently a York River National Historic Register site, so it's a protected site. This register that we're looking at is a smaller area that's focused very much on the wrecks. We've looked at some of the other sanctuary sites that are under consideration right now and some of the hurdles they've run into, and we're trying to be very proactive because we don't want to restrict access. We don't want to restrict fishing. We don't want to restrict landowner rights. In Wisconsin, there's a site where landowners have raised red flags because they're worried about their ability to build piers. Their riparian rights might be infringed, and they won't be, but we're actually suggesting a border that's 200 feet away from the shoreline, so that doesn't even become an issue. We don't want to step on the toes of the private landowners. And we also are very aware of the Mallows Bay issues that have come up and that have recently been resolved. And part of how that's been resolved is a memo of agreement with NOAA and the folks in Maryland assuring that the existing Maryland agencies that regulate the Potomac will continue to have that job, and it's not NOAA that will step in and do that. This is a process where a community can come together, develop a nomination, submit it to NOAA, and then NOAA has the option of sending it back if they haven't completed the form properly. They have the option of reviewing it further and deciding that it doesn't meet enough criteria and sending it back. Or they have the option of putting it into a hopper, basically, where it can then go into a federal process where there are where there is public review and where there are several further steps. So really where we are is developing a nomination that would simply go into a hopper for the next level before the real public scrutiny would become available for that. We're not ready to submit the nomination yet. We're at a point right now where we're reaching out to groups like this, to some of the other community groups. We're seeking support. We have a number of letters of support, but we're seeking more, and we want to make sure that all of our key constituents are on board before we move forward on this. And really what we want to do with these meetings is address any questions or concerns that you may have. So I'd like to ask if you have any questions or concerns.
Committee members? Mike, you have some questions?
Yes, sir.
The information we got before the meeting indicated that there were other organizations besides yours that were involved in this. Who are the other organizations
involved in this nomination process?
Correct.
The committee consists of a number of folks that includes the Waterman's Museum in Yorktown, the Jamestown Yorktown Foundation, which operates the American Revolution Museum at Yorktown, some at-large citizens, a former member of the Department of Historic Resources is on the committee, and we're reaching out further and further for other organizations. Does that answer what you're asking?
All right, okay.
That's the committee.
All right. You mentioned access a minute ago. Talk about access. How is access going to be restricted, or is it?
It's not.
At all. So I can
let me say this. There are certain restrictions under the York River National Historic Register, so there are some fishing restrictions in that area. So nothing new.
Nothing new. I can continue to run my boat through this area.
We encourage it.
I can jump off the boat and swim around or do whatever I want
to
do.
We want people to kayak in the area. We want people to discover the importance. Really, something I didn't mention earlier in my opening remarks is that this is an incredibly important site in American history, and these wrecks are a part of that. And we want to bring the information out about that. We want to bring people to Yorktown, to the resource, in boats, to Yorktown Beach. Absolutely.
Help me understand, if there's no restrictions in terms of access, what this is really going to do.
It's going to provide an opportunity for further research.
You already have that, though, do you not, without the sanctuary designation? Is there anything stopping your research?
This makes it easier to get resources for research for a visitor center for educational resources.
Easier? What kind of, you mean like funding to do things?
Funding is a part of it, because NOAA would provide funding for this, so it doesn't affect the local funding.
You understand people have some hesitation when the federal government gets involved.
I absolutely understand. And that's why we're here. We want to hear your
concerns.
Once
they get a hold of something, it's done.
That's why we're trying to be very proactive in shrinking the site and focusing on the wrecks. That's our objective.
My questions were primarily about access, and if he says there's no change in that, I have no other questions at this point.
Okay, I believe Mike at the end has some questions.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'm a commercial waterman, and I'm also part of the Watermen's Associations on the Potomac, so I've been following the Mallows Bay sanctuary process for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope to get our lead waterman, who's president of the Potomac Watermen's Association, Monica, to come. But our only concern, and you've addressed it, saying that there will be no changes on access to commercial fishing, and I assume that's also for the existing and requested leases for oyster ground.
Yes, sir.
And so, and our concern with the Mallows Bay was that it wasn't this it wasn't in writing. So we pushed, and an MOU was created between NOAA and Governor Hogan, and
mm-hmm.
that was signed. And it assures that no impacts to commercial or recreational fishing. So I hope an MOU would be done with this one as well.
I would absolutely encourage and will pursue that.
So then the only question that I have is we didn't have this issue with Mallows Bay because there's no oysters up there. The water's too fresh. But what do you do with is there any oyster grounds where a wreck is?
I don't believe there are any oyster grounds where a wreck is. There are some, John, you've got the oyster map.
There are none where the wrecks are.
There are some that are in the fringe of the sanctuary. Is that about a good way to put it?
Yeah, I think... you can, if you see, they're sort of shaded in there.
Yes.
It's a little hard to see them, but
this is drawn from the oyster ground map.
That's right. That's on the MRC website, and we just tried to overlay the big boundary, the historic register boundary, and then where we envision the sanctuary boundary being. So there is still some overlap, but basically, even though there are some oyster leases within that National Register area, there aren't any restrictions. There's no effort to enforce any cultural resource laws right now, so we don't anticipate anything in the future.
And that's the state's purview for the oyster leases.
Right, yeah.
Rob O'Reilly mentioned there's another committee for shellfish, and this is really their jurisdiction. I just wanted to ask this for the Watermen's Associations, but if everything is written as it and assured in an MOU as it was with Mallows Bay, then speaking for myself as a waterman and for our two watermen's associations, we're okay with it.
That's really good to hear.
In writing.
Yeah, I'm glad you've been involved in the Mallows Bay. I've been trying to kind of keep up with it too remotely. And I was glad to see that they came to an agreement. I think what the process up there has shown, and it gives us more confidence in what we're doing, because I think NOAA got the objections. They took them to heart. They reopened public hearings and, went back through the process to try to find something that works for everybody. And so So that's what we're expecting down here. And a little side note, full disclosure, I spent 18 years as part of the sanctuary program. I was in charge of the monitor off Cape Hatteras, but I attended meetings and was involved in a lot of the other ones, including the designation up in Michigan of the Thunder Bay Sanctuary, which is another shipwreck sanctuary. And that one started out as a real conflict. We actually had the governor of Michigan say that he was never going to let a sanctuary in his state. They finally agreed on something similar to Malice Bay, where there would be a five-year period where if after 5 years the state still thought it was a bad deal, they could withdraw and the sanctuary would be, we can't be canceled. Mm-hmm. And at the end of that five-year period, there was such public support, they actually increased the size of the sanctuary about five times. So it's been a real success up there. And the other thing I wanted to mention, too, is that one of the things I thought was so good about being working for the sanctuary program was it's a federal government program that I think may have the highest level of public participation. It's certainly the highest of any I'm aware of. So with each sanctuary, there's an advisory committee that's formed, and there are up to 15 members and 15 alternates. And within that advisory committee, just about every special interest group, every group that has any concern about the sanctuary, watermen, sport divers, local businessmen, you name it, everybody has a seat at the advisory committee. And so I found that to be a really successful way of, the problems come to our table every time we have a meeting. It's usually a monthly meeting. And that way things didn't fester and get worse. They were dealt with right away. And it's worked out pretty successfully. So I'm hoping as they worked it out up at Malice Bay that we'd have no trouble in following the same sort of procedure and doing it here.
Will this do anything to prohibit public diving on the wrecks? Because correct me if I'm wrong, the monitor off of Hatteras, once it was, there was no more diving.
Actually, it took a while, but you could always get a permit to do research. And then when I came on board in 1992, we opened it up and we actually issued a concession. One of the reasons that diving was restricted initially was because at the time the monitor became a sanctuary, diving, it's 240 feet down, so there was such a safety issue. NOAA was concerned about letting divers go out there. But we worked with, again, working with the divers, we realized that the technology for deep diving had improved and had gotten much safer. And so I think it was 1996 or so, thereabouts, that maybe even earlier, we actually issued a concession to a we put it in the Federal Register and selected a concessionaire to take divers out to the monitor. And so that concessionaire was in charge of the safety and access to the site. But it worked out that we've had hundreds of divers out there. And
so that won't change? Public will be able to dive?
Yeah, currently there are no restrictions, even though it is a National Register site. There's no restrictions on diving. And, in fact, what we're really hoping is it will go just the other way. Right now, I don't think very many divers go out there. If you've ever dived in the York River, it's not the best place to dive. Pretty much zero visibility all the time and currents to deal with. But what we're hoping is that we can actually initiate a program where divers would come and get to visit the sites, and we'd have an interpretive program and do the same sorts of things we do in the Florida Keys and Thunder Bay, where we work with divers and we go collect enough information that we actually can draw diagrams of what the wrecks look like on the bottom, and then when divers go down they can take the diagram and it kind of helps them get around. So we're actually hoping to increase access. It's part of the purpose. All the sanctuaries, once they're designated, they set up an office. They frequently have a visitor center that has basically a small museum. It would be something that would be in concert with Romans and the American Revolution Museum staff. And that's sort of how this thing becomes a value added. You know, the local staff kind of pulls in NOAA resources, works with locals like VIMS and our agency at Department of Historic Resources and others to sort of pull everybody together to increase access, increase research, and learn more about the ships. That's really ultimately what we're looking for, is a way to make this site better known and to tell the story of how these ships played such a role in America becoming an independent nation. So.
Great. Ernie?
One word you used several times when you were talking about is currently. Currently, there's no restriction. Currently, that really concerns me. And I'll give you why. They established the Chincoteague National Wildlife Refuge in the early 60s and had agreement with the state and stuff. The federal government owned it to the low water like anybody else in the state of Virginia would own. Then in the 80s, some bureaucrat, nothing to do with Congress, some bureaucrat in the Park Service made a half-mile boundary around everything. Now that, you know, that might have been published in the Federal Register, and you have a lot of well-funded groups, environmental groups and different things that really look at everything in the Federal Register and know what's going on. The rest of us don't. We won't know what's going on. You know, until 10 years ago, I didn't even know there was a Federal Register, probably 15 years ago. We had no chance to comment on none of that. And they've done it not just at the Wildlife Refuge. They've done it everywhere. They're claiming a half a mile around it. Mr. Arada, I believe, was at a meeting we had. I've made so many concerns that they made a special presentation for me to town of Chincoteague. And then we later had one at a community college, which a lot of people from VMRC attended. And they were trying to shut down oyster leases, clam leases, fishing, horseshoe crabs, which were probably, a lot of them are caught in between high and low water, which they could probably do. But, you know, when you say currently, that doesn't mean 10 years down the road, 5 years down the road. You all can have the best pets in the world, and I'm not trying to imply that you don't, but we're not going to be here forever. And hopefully, if you have a sanctuary, it will be. You know, I don't know how you could have something that would be ironclad, that if any changes are made to it by either side, it's null and void. That would be the only way I could support it. Because if 10 years down the road, they change things and make it off limit, it's going to show up in the Federal Register. I'm trying to think, but he might still be around 10 years. But most of these people are. A lot of these people are going to be retired, including myself. So we're not going to know. And then all of a sudden, you know, we've ceded Commonwealth of Virginia land to the federal government. I'd much rather see Virginia make a sanctuary there, because we do have opportunities to address issues. On the federal side, you do not. And that Marine Fisheries Service, from what I've seen, is worse than the Park Service. We've had very little input. We've tried very hard on input on a lot of the take reduction plans and stuff, and we just haven't had much luck with them. And, you know, maybe with this administration, I think we would, but you don't know what the next one will be. And that's my main concern, because, you know, when you said that currently, that implies right now it's not, and you're hoping in the foreseeable future things don't change. But we don't know that, and that's my main concern. I have really no concern with the idea of preserving stuff. That's no big deal. But I just hate to cede our authority to the federal government, and we have no input. And I'm afraid that's what will happen. And when you talk about Thunder Bay and Merlin and stuff, is that part of the agreement saying that if something does change, they have the opportunity to pull out, or they have to pull out within 5 years?
They had that for the first 5 years, but I think at the end of that 5 years, everyone agreed that it was a good thing, and I honestly can't tell you whether they added another 5 year review period or whether they closed it off. But
the Mallows Bay has a contingency to pull out.
Yeah,
the Mallows Bay memo, and that's certainly
some bureaucrat decides they want to change that.
And we're also at a point where we have not submitted anything, and so we want to address these kinds of issues, and that's something we can look at for a memo of understanding when we look at the similar Mallows Bay type of.
Right. Yeah. You know, I think we talk about this in our committee meetings a lot. We understand that there's you never know what's going to happen tomorrow. I mean, it's already a National Register district, so Congress could actually increase the restrictions on National Register districts without the sanctuary. So there are all sorts of, and or the state could issue some sort of restrictions. So there's no guarantees, but it looks, I think the system has been in operation now since the 1970s. Monitored was designated in 75, and some of our offshore sanctuaries don't have this concern because they're all in federal waters. But the ones that are coexisting and co-managed with state waters, they've pretty much done what they promised to do, and like the protections put on Malis Bay to give as much guarantee as you can give. You know, nobody can say absolutely nothing will ever change, but I think any sanctuary we put in down here would certainly have the same types of guarantees and backups.
And in writing.
But you know, yeah. along with more funding comes more conflict, because groups are scrambling for funding, and you know, a lot of universities live and die on funding, and a lot of other things, not just universities, different environmental groups and things. And I'm just afraid, with increased funding, increased conflict, more conflict, the more they're going to go to try things, have it changed. And that's my only really problem is, you know, right now what your suggestion is something that I think most people can live with. But you don't know 5 years. You don't know 10 years. We just, that's my major concern. We don't know down the road.
I certainly understand that major concern. Again, something we've talked about, and also why we're trying to be proactive and what kinds of things can we put in writing and make our preservation of the wrecks and study the wrecks.
We're just at the draft stage now, and we will be able to comment on the formal presentation when it comes out. And
absolutely, there are the public process really kicks into gear 2 or 3 steps from. I mean,
right? Yeah, we're early on here.
We're in January, and December is the end. Is kind of how I look at it. It's a draft to be considered.
Mr. Powers,
to follow up on what Jeff just mentioned, I think to be more clear, what Jeff is asking for is before it gets to the point where you go to public hearing with it and you get a public input from some federal or state agency, what we're requesting is that you bring it back here with plenty of time for us to discuss it and fine-tune some of the things you put in there to make sure that they address the issues. And to give you some examples of issues that I'm concerned about that I just jotted down. Number one, you get a 40-foot boat comes in there and says, I want to anchor overnight, and they put down a really nice Danforth anchor, and they start dredging the bottom with that anchor and hanging into your wreck. Is that going to be allowed? I mean, that's the kind of thing I wonder. I'm a recreational fisherman with my little 16-foot boat. I only have a little 10-pound anchor, 12-pound. Well, there I'd probably need a 15 with a 10-foot piece of chain. But can I throw that over my boat and anchor up and hook onto your wreck? Are these wrecks above the bottom, or are they submerged under 3 feet of mud? I mean, I don't know the answer. I'd love to know the answer to that question when I'm done with this. Another one is gill nets. Gill nets use anchors. When I set a gill net in the years gone by when I did, I used a Navy anchor that had tines on it that were this long. That would definitely sink into the mud a little ways and grab your wreck, or maybe even pick up a piece of it that I get a souvenir to take home, which I bet you're not going to allow. Oyster dredging, if somebody gets a lease on that ground, they can dredge by right on their lease. Are you going to allow that? Tongs for clams. I don't know if this area is tonged, if they use patent tongs in this area. I know areas they do it. I don't know if this is one of them. Are you going to allow patent tongs to be used on these areas if they happen to be areas where people like to clam? Those are just the kinds of issues I would be concerned about. Another broader issue is VMRC has committed to, with Maryland, to put a number of sanctuary reefs in unleashed grounds in the York River. And we're talking a lot of acreage for that. This acreage may be prime area for that. Are you willing to have VMRC come in and put 2 feet of rock over top of what you're doing? Is substrate for, or granite is substrate for oysters, or 2 feet of oyster shells on the bottom to build up some oyster reefs in there? I mean, those are the kinds of questions that I would be concerned about.
Good questions all. And definitely, I'm making mental notes as you
this
talk.
This meeting is recorded and will be on the VMRC webpage probably within a week.
Well, good. So we don't have to write them down because we can find the questions. But
yeah, thank you.
I will, yes.
They're very valid questions. Thank you.
And there are some existing restrictions, if I'm not mistaken, as a National Register.
Yeah, that's right. The fact that it's on the National Register does give the area some types of protection. And I can't really tell you exactly what those are, but major anchors and things like that.
How do I know that?
How do I know that I can't do that?
I don't think I've ever seen a sign in the river saying you can't do that here. When I go around Plum Tree Island, there's a restricted sign that I don't like, but there are signs near the shoreline 100 yards out or so that say you can't anchor or touch the bottom within these signs, or actually they say no trespassing, but they're supposed to say they can't touch the bottom. But how are people going to know this?
That will be an information point for you to provide, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Excellent questions.
Right. John?
I have a follow-up. You mentioned,
yes, sir.
The organizations you mentioned and individuals that are involved with your committee, I didn't hear you mention VIMS. I mean, this is right at, on their doorstep.
Mm-hmm.
What's their position?
We have a representative from VIMS who has attended a few of our meetings and we've been communicating with. There's not a VIMS representative on our committee.
There is not a representative from VIMS on your committee?
Not right now, no.
That's unfortunate.
No, Mark Luckenbach has been attending the meetings, but strictly from an advisory capacity. He says he feels like at this point with this kind of discussion that VIMS can advise, but really not in a position to endorse or take sides on it. But he's been very helpful in giving us feedback and comments on laws and restrictions and things that we need to take into account.
What depths are we looking at for the ships?
They're almost all in shallow water on either the Gloucester side or the Yorktown side, 30 feet or less. Okay. There are a couple in deeper water, but for the most part, they're shallow.
All right.
And within that area on the map there.
One more specific thing. There is a public fishing pier on the Gloucester side that I think is longer than 200 feet. Be 100 feet past that when you do your boundaries.
We got that 200 number from someone who said that's where the riparian rights normally end. In other words, there's a restriction for building a pier beyond a certain distance. So we can also adjust
in the nomination.
A public fishing pier that I believe is owned by the state.
Yeah, we can also adjust in the nomination the existing piers on both sides of the river.
Yeah, the same. Yeah, exactly.
Are not affected because that fishing pier on Gloucester is not affecting any wrecks.
Right.
Okay, if we could ask the audience, is there anyone that wants to comment? This young lady.
Okay. All right.
Come up and be recorded.
Talk
into the mic, tell us your name and who you represent.
That way you're on the recording that people can listen to next week.
My name is Teresa Vaughn, and I don't represent anyone. I'm just here. The question, so you got 25 wrecks, one has been discovered. How do you know that 25, the other 24, is in your perimeter that you're trying to sanction?
We actually have 10. So we've got 7 known wrecks on the Yorktown shore, 2 on the Gloucester shore, and we don't know how many more are there. They may have been salvaged over the years, may have been salvaged right after the battle. So we're always looking. We just did a survey a couple of weeks ago, and we're hoping to go back out again. So we look periodically, but the rest may be gone. We don't have any evidence.
We
get those numbers from the historic records based on how many wrecks Cornwallis scuttled.
Right.
But 10, you said 10 have been discovered on the Yorktown side.
Well, 7 on Yorktown, or 8 on the Yorktown side, and 2 on Gloucester. So far.
So you may at some point extend the perimeter. So that's something to think about if you're thinking there may be 25.
That's a good point. Yeah, the reason we drew the perimeters where we did is because we have historic maps that show, we have two different really good historic maps. They're very accurate, and they show the anchorages where the ships were located and where they were scuttled or sunk by cannon fire. And so we tried to draw the boundary just to encompass those. When they did the National Register nomination back in the 70s, they didn't really know for sure where the ships might be, so they just kind of made it bigger to make sure they captured everything. Now we have a better idea where they are, so we're trying to shrink the area to make more of the... Because we attended a meeting of the commission here a couple of years ago, I guess, and there were a couple of oyster leases being proposed, and they were being held up because they were within the National Register boundary. And so what we're trying to do is constantly refine the data we have and shrink it down so that we're not occupying any more territory than we need to. So that's why it's where it is now.
And I'm not sure if this can be done, but to bring to their point, maybe there's markers you can put where you know where the 10, just the, you know, one,
yeah,
two.
Possibly, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else in the audience? Yes, sir, please.
My name is Stan Sutliff, and a private citizen. Just a question, please. Is the ultimate intent to bring these vessels to the surface and put them into a museum, or to leave them in the murky waters unlike in Florida, where we have a national deep water place? Well, what's the ultimate intent here?
Ultimate intent is to leave them there as far as any of us are concerned.
So the restrictions that you're proposing that might upset their current condition would go on would continue forever.
The existing restrictions that are there for the National Register, which...
Okay.
Those are in place.
Yeah, we're not looking to raise them, but to study them. And
okay.
There's no reason that we couldn't excavate further ships like the one we did off the Cofferdam.
Right.
But it's just so prohibitively expensive. It's very difficult to get funding to do that sort of project.
So the sensitivity about oyster beds and fishing and laying anchors and all that stuff is why these guys are so sensitive about it?
Sure.
Okay. All right. Yes. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Allen?
My name is Robert Allen. I'm a recreational fisherman. I haven't fished in 20 years, and I haven't been to this meeting in about 15 or 20 years, but this issue came up, and it woke me out of sleep and brought me out here. I'd like to know more about the wreck at the end of at the cofferdam. Can you tell me what you found when you put the cofferdam up and you filtered that water and you sent divers down? What was the purpose of the cofferdam, and what was discovered? I mean, what new things were brought to light from that? Can you tell us?
Sure, be glad to. Yeah, when we did the surveys initially back in 1978 and 79, that's when we found most of the wrecks. We've added a couple since then, but so we knew that there were wrecks all along the Yorktown Beach, and it was almost identical, and our survey map almost looked exactly like the 200-year-old maps that were done showing where the ships were scuttled. So they were right where these engineers and map makers said they would be. So we looked at all of them as best we could, and we chose the one to build the cofferdam around based on the amount of preservation. And so when we built the cofferdam and cleared the water up a little bit and got rid of the strong currents and the jellyfish and all, we were able to tell that we had one of the merchant vessels, and it was preserved just about up to the water line. Parts of the deck, the wooden deck on the lower part, were still preserved, and the two masts were still stepped in place, and we had bulkheading fore and aft, and so everything was kind of divided up into compartments. And so we learned a lot from the wreck about merchant vessels. We eventually identified it as the Betsy. It was built in a little town up in the northwest coast of England called Whitehaven, and we found out that its captain, Joseph Young's husband, had been in the coal trade, and he'd been carrying coal to Dublin. Every 6 weeks he'd take a load of coal to Dublin, and he met his wife there and brought her back, and her name was Elizabeth, so he named the ship Betsy after his wife. So we've got a wonderful story behind this ship, And there's probably a story like that for all the rest of them, but not likely we're going to get the funding to do that again. But that's pretty much what we know. There are a few of the artifacts from that ship on exhibit in Yorktown as well.
I want to thank you for that explanation. Your horizon now is much broader now. You know much more about those wrecks after what they did, and I hope it's covered back up under the mud like
yes,
it should
sir.
Be, like
yes,
it should
sir.
Be, and like all of these wrecks should be left alone. They've been there 200 years, and they ought to be left alone, and I am very much opposed to your proposal.
Thank you, Dr. Hammer. Appreciate your input. Okay, Rob, are you... I'm sorry. Oh, we got one more. Okay.
I always wait till the end. My summary of this whole thing is that they've been there for hundreds of years. The public really didn't care whether they were there or not. So now you want to make it a sanctuary which could put restrictions on the public so that you can get the public's funding, their tax money, to do what y'all want to do.
Well, we want to actually increase the access to the...
I mean, these ships been there for over 200 years, and nobody cares about it but y'all.
Well,
so now you want to use my tax money for y'all's enjoyment to go down and look at these ships or whatever.
No, that's
not... I mean, you can go down there without making it a sanctuary because you're putting me in jeopardy because any time the government gets in, just like Ernie said, you're going to get restrictions. We're going to end up with restrictions on us so y'all can have y'all's way.
Well, I understand what you're saying right now, and for the indefinite future, I don't think there are going to be any more of us diving there, certainly not with public money. I've been out there 2 weeks ago. We paid for all of it ourselves. It was all done by volunteers, and I don't foresee any NOAA money going into excavating any more of these ships. That's not the intention, at least.
Well,
I mean,
there's really no reason to protect them in place. No reasonable reason to have the boundary then, the sanctuary.
Well, I would argue that there's a great interest in the ships from having worked at the American Revolution Museum.
Ask anybody in here if they are interested in them ships.
Well, I'm sure there are a lot of people who are not. Yes, sir. I also know from working at the American Revolution Museum at Yorktown that there are hundreds of thousands of visitors that come and want to learn about Yorktown, and this is a key part of that story. So I respectfully disagree. I think that there are people who care, and I think it can tell an important lesson about American history, and that's why I care about it.
Okay.
We actually had an article on the Betsy in National Geographic magazine in 1988, and we have a film crew that's coming over to do a segment for a National Geographic TV series called Draining the Oceans, and they're going to drain the York River and look at these ships that played a part in the American Revolution. So it's
figuratively.
It's like figuratively, yeah. Promise we won't have an ultra-low tide. But the idea is that these ships... Maybe people haven't cared about them because nobody has taken the trouble to study them and tell their story. But there are thousands, I don't know how many thousands of people that walk the battlefields there at Yorktown every year. But the other half of the battlefield is in the river where these ships are. And that's the story we want to tell. That's the story we think that having a sanctuary would help tell.
If you could raise them up so that the public could see them, then it might be beneficial.
Well,
but for them just to remain down on the mud where nobody can see them, I don't see any sense in it.
Well, the idea is to kind of help people to visualize what they're like through computer graphics, telling stories. And like for the Betsy, even though we only had it preserved up to the waterline, there's a model at the Victory Center that's absolutely, I bet it's 98% accurate of showing the whole ship with sails and masts and everything. And that was based on the archaeology we did. So, you know, there are lots of ways with today's technology to tell that story and to give people a picture without spending the millions of dollars to raise the ship. So, again, the only way we could raise the ship and put it through that preservation treatment that is so expensive would be to use public funds. I don't think anybody privately would pay for it.
Just one more thing. In simple language, what would this sanctuary benefit? What would it actually do?
In simple language, it would help us to learn more about what happened during the Siege of Yorktown and allow us to share that information with school children, with tourists who come to Yorktown, and through websites, we could share that information around the world. That's why I care about this, is the educational possibilities that we have.
Okay.
Thank you. We have one more audience member.
Yes, my name is Wes Blow, recreational fisherman. I don't see how you can't do all that stuff without making a sanctuary. You know, you can do your everything that you just said in the last 2 minutes, you could do it without a sanctuary. Making this a sanctuary is going to hurt recreational fishermen at some point. It's going to hurt commercial fishermen. There's no sanctuary that ends up being a good thing for the recreational and commercial fishermen. And explain to me why you can't do what you want without making a sanctuary, other than your funding.
I would say the best answer I can give to that is the sanctuary brings an infrastructure that helps form a cohesive body among all the local and federal and state agencies. And it, from my experience and from what I've read from the other sanctuaries, it just provides an extra layer of coordination and some funding. But mainly it's just to coordinate the resources that are already in an area and available but haven't gotten together. And it's worked in other areas. That's the best answer I can give you.
But you're not telling me why you can't do that without making a sanctuary.
Who's going to do it? That's been our problem. No agency will step forward and say, okay, I'm going to coordinate all these things. Virginia doesn't have a program for sanctuaries or marine preserves. Some other states do. But Virginia doesn't have one. And so we don't know where else to turn. We think the sanctuary program is a good fit.
I think a sanctuary is going to hurt recreational fishermen and commercial fishermen in the long run, and I would be against it.
Okay, Jeff. Thank you.
I might add, I did hear from the Chincoteague Charter boat captains, and they are against it as well, just so you know what the pros and cons are from us. Yes, sir, Tom.
So you say there's no umbrella organization that will take ownership. What about the Yorktown Foundation or whatever it is that runs that park?
National Park Service
owns it. Why aren't they coordinating? You said that this was a shipwreck national registry. This is part of that, I assume. So fine, it's designated as a national registry. You can't go in there right now and dive down there. I'm sure it's illegal to go down there and dive down there and start grabbing pieces of these ships and bring them up and saying, I'm going to sell souvenirs of these, or I'm just going to keep them in my private collection, or I'm going to take them to a museum because you didn't get a permit to do that. So we don't need something to protect it. We already have it because it's a national shipwreck registry. And you say there's no umbrella organization that's what the Yorktown Park Service is doing for the whole whatever it is, town of Yorktown down there, whatever they call the little area. I have a friend that lives there, can't do anything to his house because that's where he lives, which he's happy with, don't get me wrong. But I agree with Wes when he said that, or Mr. Blow when he said that there's no reason that we have to do this just so you can organize it. You have the National Park Service. They should be doing their job in organizing it because this is an extension of their park. But it's covered by this Shipwreck National Registry. That's where you should be seeking your funding.
We have had discussions like that with the Park Service in the past, and their response is that their jurisdiction ends at the water line. They don't have any jurisdiction over the bottom
line. Nobody's asking them to have jurisdiction. It's already protected. What you're looking at is historic interpretation. That's what they have the authority to do, is historic interpretation.
All right.
Yeah, I don't understand how they can claim a half a mile around Assateague and they can't claim a half a mile around Yorktown.
Well, you don't want to claim
jurisdiction on one. The Park Service has jurisdiction on both.
Yeah, I know there is a special way that they designate these areas. I think it's only seashores that can extend into the water like that, but I'm not even sure about that. Could be parks as well.
Okay, so you see what we have to offer.
Yes, sir, and we thank you all for your time today, and thank you for your comments, because this really does help us as we continue to think about what the best thing is for this resource.
Well, I agree. It's a historically significant space. I forgot how much I had ever learned about it until I reviewed it for your presentation. And the last battle of the American Revolutionary War is pretty serious.
Yes, sir.
Rob, do you need anything from us to pass on to the commission?
No. I think at this stage, we just follow this. I heard a request that when it gets more towards the public comment period to come back.
Yes.
My understanding are there's going to be a few public comment periods throughout this process.
Absolutely.
And the ultimate would be with NOAA. So,
all this
so
does
I think we're good. We have an understanding of the situation. Have your viewpoints, and we'll just go from there.
And please don't hesitate to get directly in touch. We can provide you with our you probably have our contact information, and be glad to continue the dialogue. We appreciate y'all, all your comments and your time. Thanks.
Wes has one more comment, if you may.
Does staff have an opinion on it?
Does staff? No, because it's way too early. Way too early.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate it.
Okay.
Now we get to talk about striped bass.
Cobia.
That's what it's called.
Striped brown fish.
When you're young, they're striped.
Oh, okay. That's in the yellow one. Thank you. Let me just give a brief update on cobia management and things that are going on. As you're well aware, cobia management is transitioning from the federal government, which was managed by the South Atlantic Fisheries Management Council since 1990 under the Coastal Migratory Pelagic FMP. The stock assessment that was in 2013 had an ACL of 620,000 pounds of commercial ACL of 50,000. We're still at present working on those numbers. There were recreational overages in 2015 and 2016 that closed federal waters. It really didn't affect Virginia too much because we were fishing almost exclusively in state waters. And as a result of those closures, the following year they had to take those overages. The following year, the season closed in 2016 in June 20th. And the following year, we didn't really have a season. It closed in January. As a result of that, the South Atlantic Fisheries Management Council started a conversation with the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission and say, look, we need to probably have joint and complementary management of this species, primarily because 86% of the harvest is occurring in state waters, where South Atlantic, the federal government didn't have any jurisdiction over. And those early closures, they affected states disproportionately. Didn't really affect Virginia too much, but some of the other states, Georgia, South Carolina, primarily affected them. They didn't have much of a season. So we've been working towards the process of transitioning management over to the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. The commission, the council, the South Atlantic Council has done what they have to do. It's all ready to go, and ASMFC is completing an Amendment 1. We're going to have a public hearing on that tomorrow night, and I hope that you can all be there again. But I'll give you some brief updates on some of that information. But the Amendment 1 is to deal with bringing that over into the ASMFC management regime and how they do it and how they're going to deal with managing federal waters and things like that. And so they're going to be voting on that in their meeting in August, and at that point, management will be under ASMSC and with the state's involvement. Looking at commercial landings, commercial and recreational landings, Virginia and North Carolina are driving these fisheries, both recreationally and commercially. About 90% commercial is coming from Virginia and North Carolina, and about 85% over the last 10 years are coming from those two states. Most of the other states are, just small participants in the fishery. You can see the numbers are, generally increasing. The blue line on there is the commercial landings from National Marine Fisheries Service. And the
red line are the new MREP numbers. The new MREP numbers that are coming out, that's the recreational estimates that we're using. As Rob said earlier, these new estimates we're using for MREP, we have to go ahead for all of our species and develop new control measures and new reference points. So the reference point of 620,000 pounds, that ACL will probably, you know, it's probably going to change when we have a stock assessment. And the first two that we had was striped bass and summer flounder that were just recently completed. But as the species come up in the schedule for new stock assessments, they're going to be using these new MREP numbers, and we can expect to see some changes. We'll see some changes in those numbers as a result of these, you know, MREP numbers that are generally higher. These are the numbers specific to Virginia, and you can see estimates. The blue is the recreational, and the red dotted line. And I did that for people who are colorblind. I think someone said that last meeting. There we go. So it's dotted, so you can see it. Excuse me.
Two scales.
We have on the left is the recreational harvest, which is in millions of pounds, and on the right is the commercial harvest, which is in thousands of pounds. So in 2018 in Virginia, we harvested about 25,000 pounds. And recreationally, it was the highest ever. We had 1.94 million pounds using the new MREP numbers. This is under, you know, I've had a lot of folks call me and go, what's going on here? These numbers are so high when we have a 620,000 pound ACL for recreational. But that's with the old MREP numbers. That quota was 620,000 pounds. Virginia's recreational soft target under that was about 244,000 pounds. Alex had done some of the estimates and looking at what our value should be under the old MREP numbers would be about 832,000 pounds. So it was still, you know, 3.4 times higher than that soft target that we're seeing. And I show this graph because what this is doing is it's showing the red line is the new MREP numbers versus the blue line is the old MREP numbers. And that yellow horizontal line is the ACL of 620,000 pounds. So you can see how the numbers, they're increasing with the new MREP numbers. And, you know, and to what scale. It's not consistent. It's not direct. You know, we can look at the numbers and say over time it's a 3.4 times higher, but on any given year it's not always the same. So it's just showing that there is an increase with these numbers, and it's going to affect, you know, our management moving forward, and it's definitely going to affect the new stock assessment. We do have our own survey that we've been doing with the mandatory reporting that a lot of you participated in the past. We only have 3 years of data, though. 2016 was the first year that we started it. We had minimum participation in it. In 2017 and 2018, a lot more participation. We've had, you can see the number of permits that we issue on an annual basis. It's over 7,000 permits were issued in 2008 for the cobia permit. In 2016, it was 449. Like I said, that wasn't a full year. In 2017, it was just under 6,800. So those permits are increasing. And what this is showing is the number of permits, the total number of fish that, you know, you're required to report the information if you catch or release the cobia, you're supposed to report it. You're supposed to report within a certain amount of days. Recently, we changed our regulation that says you have to report within 21 days of catching it, or when the season closes, you have to. And if you don't report moving forward, you will not get a permit the following year. So starting next year, if you don't report in a timely fashion, you won't be able to get a permit. But you can kind of see the numbers on there for 2008. Alex went ahead and said, well, we have a number of folks that didn't report. We had about 62% reporting from the private sector, and that's overall. When the season ends and we said, okay, they have X amount of time, 21 days to report, at that point it was only 56%. So right after the season ended, about 56% of the people reported. What ends up happening is before the next season starts, right before it starts, a lot of people will go into the system and go ahead and, you know, you go to get your permits for the following year, it says right now, it's just you can't get it because you didn't report your landings or you didn't report your trips. They reported at that time. So you can still do that this year. You won't be able to do it next year. So, and these numbers are dramatically lower than what MREP is reporting. MREP is reporting for 2018 for the total catch was 275,000 fish versus what we're seeing as an expanded number of about 27,000.
So what is, how are they doing the release? I'm sorry, Jeff. I'm just going to ask.
Okay, Tom.
How are they doing the release mortality on these fish? I mean, we're not killing 27,000 cobia.
100%.
My understanding is they live pretty well when you catch them and turn them loose.
Right. So that's just the total that were caught. That were caught.
I understand.
Yeah. But we have a release category, so that's release. And you know, Alex, what is the estimate on 5% of
okay,
release
so,
mortality?
So divide by five, or you know, okay. So
really, what you want to look at on that is the expanded capped. What was capped? That's what was harvested. I mean, our survey, you know, we have a lot of confidence in our survey. We think it can be a good survey, but it's, you know, we've only been doing it for a couple of years. So it's, we're having some growing pains with that, but we hope to get better. And it's like, you know, with this recent regulation, that we hope that it'll put some teeth in it and have people report on a more timely basis so that they can maintain their participation in the fishery. So what's happening next? Like I said, the amendment for FMP, that's going to be approved in August. If anybody wants to come tomorrow, sitting here for another 2 hours tomorrow night, you can listen to ASMFC staff talk about the amendment that we're putting forward. It's dealing with the transfer of management to ASMFC, as I mentioned, how to address allocations, management in federal waters. The stock assessment has been delayed a little bit. It was supposed to be done later this year, but because of the federal closure beginning of the year, it's probably been delayed a little bit. So towards the end of this year, early 2020, it will be done. What the amendment is doing, one of the things the amendment is doing, and I think we might get this in the next slide. One of the things the amendment is doing is they didn't want to have to go do this amendment that they had to do to bring the management under ASMFC. And then immediately after stock assessment is done, they may have to go do another amendment. So they're creating harvest specifications where they'll be allowed to create the coastwide total harvest, vessel limits, possession and bag limits, minimum size, and commercial closure trigger mechanism through this amendment. So they won't have to go through another amendment process. And then some of those options are you can do it for a two-year period, you can do it for a three-year period, or you can do it for a four-year period. So those are some of the options. You know, there's some of those are the things that will be considered, you know, the public comment, whether or not we should do that process every 2 years or should we do it for a longer period of time will be decided. The sector quotas will remain the same. Right now it's 92% recreational, 8% commercial. That will remain the same. The size limits for recreational, the amendment has a status quo for recreational 36 inch fork limit or 40 inch total limit. Commercial, they have the status quo at 33 inches fork length, but they've also recommended an option of 36 inches fork length, make it the same as the recreational fishery as well. The pet possession limit for recreational remains the same, status quo one fish per person per day. The commercial is also status quo two per person per day. The vessel limit recreationally remains up to. The states can have, we have less, but each state can have up to six fish per vessel per day. It's up to the state if they want to have less. Right now, the commercial is at six. That's the status quo. They're also suggesting five and four. So those are some of the options. The states can always be more restrictive. The seasonal allocation for recreational right now it's a combination of the 5 and the 10 year averages, and it's going to be about 39.4% of the total recreational allocation. They're looking at ways in how to deal with overages. You know, what happens when you have an overage, or how do you calculate what those allocations are? So they want to look at the three most recent years where you don't have a management change. This gets a little confusing. So like, If you have three consecutive years, they'll use that three-year average and they can estimate your allocation. Or if you have an overage, they can adjust it from that. But if you have a management change, they can only use the years since there's been a change. So if we made a change this year in our COVID regulations, when we were going, moving forward, we'd only be judged on that 1 year of information, which is, you know, could be a little dicey because, you know, if you have a really bad year, your allocation might go down. Recreationally, they're looking at the units whether or not, and commercial, whether or not the units should be in pounds or numbers. Most folks think they should be in numbers, but those are the two options moving forward. There's a commercial quota management system that they want to put into play. This really only affects, for the most part, North Carolina and Virginia, where if you're a non-de minimis state, you have to track it more closely than your mandatory reporting. Our mandatory reporting is on a monthly basis, but to stay within that, I'll use the 50,000 pounds that we have for that quota right now, to stay within that quota limit, you have to track it more frequently than monthly. So we have to develop, North Carolina and Virginia will have to develop either daily or weekly reporting for commercial. We're probably going to do a phone-in system on a weekly basis is what we're considering. They've also considered de minimis status for states. Recreationally, it's if it's two of the last three years below 1% of the coastwide harvest, you can be a de minimis state recreationally. Commercial was added as well, and it's the same thing, 2 or 3 years, but it's 2%. And they also, to make sure that to stay within the allowable catch limit, they're setting aside 3% of the commercial quota for these de minimis states because they're not going to be able to track it as quickly as, you know, Virginia and North Carolina. So they're setting a small amount aside to try to stay within the quota. I encourage anybody who wants to come tomorrow night to come to the meeting. We also have, I can give you the link to the website where you can read this whole 106-page document. But this will be voted on at the ASMSC meeting in August. The public comment period.
July 15th.
Thank you. July 15th. You know, provide any comments you want. I mean, if you're there tomorrow night, Mike Schmentke will go ahead and take your comments as well. And so that's pretty much, you know, the bulk of what's going on is an amendment. And it's, you know, what's going to happen moving forward, we don't know for sure until the stock assessment comes out at the end of the year. But our numbers are looking very high.
Any questions from the committee? Tom?
I'll go back a few slides where you had the sector allocation. There you go. So the 92%, 8%, is that based on the old MRF numbers?
It's going to stay the same.
Is it based on the old MRF numbers or the new MRF numbers?
It's based on the old stock assessment and the old numbers, yes.
So, but the old numbers, you just said, the old numbers are wrong, and they're clearly higher on the
recreation. I didn't say they were wrong. I just said they're
different.
They're different.
They're consistently higher on the recreational side.
Yeah.
So it should be something more like 95%. 5% is my thumbnail looking at the two graphs diverging.
The decision was made by the PDT to maintain the status quo on this, and they realized that because with these new MRAP numbers, you may have a non-existent commercial harvest quota.
Yeah.
Well,
I think that, I mean, personally, I think we should look at the commercial harvest in pounds of what it's been historically because we have good records of that.
Yeah.
And then you make it a reasonably generous amount because it's such a small fraction of the fishery, and set it at those pounds and then increase or decrease those pounds based on the stock, not say it's a percentage of the stock, the percentage of the harvest. Because we're looking at the same thing with flounder, only the other direction, because flounder should be not 60-40 because emerald or whatever.
I mean, they're going to run it. We're running into that with all the species.
Dr. Neal.
Right. This is not ASMSC specific. I will not be here tomorrow. It's my birthday. I'll be.
Well, happy birthday.
Mama's cooking, and it's better than what y'all feed me here. We had our meeting at Potomac Rivers last week. I mention this to Steve. I'm really concerned, and I guess you're seeing the numbers too. with Arcobia fishery. And what I mean by that, Arcobia fishery is getting too dang good. Mm-hmm. And if you believe MRIP, not even a little, okay, but you're still stuck with those numbers. And if it does show a trend, I fully expect to see numbers higher this year than last year. Mm-hmm. If it's at least a trend analysis, even if the numbers aren't real, if it's trend analysis. And what you just said is if Virginia decides to do something to curtail this ahead of ASMFC, then it could hurt our allocation in the future. It could bite us.
It may.
All right. So that's something I hadn't heard before, and that's something we're going to need to think about. The reports I'm getting is May, our closed season of May, was the best May cobia fishing we'd ever seen.
Yeah.
So that's what the charter boat guys have been telling me. And they were running trips. They were fishing. And it's continued. So it's just the only thing that slowed things up at all has been some weather.
Mm-hmm.
But when the weather's good, it's just been crazy. And when the weather's not so good, Wes still goes out there and killing them and sending me reports while I'm working, which I'm not happy about. But I am concerned. We're going to see some whether the numbers are real or not. If they really track a trend, we're going to have some real issues. And if we wait for that 3-year thing to say, hey, now you do something, it's going to be impossible to make up that type of stuff. And so I think this group and the MRC needs to start thinking about doing something to curtail it, but I don't want to hurt us down the road. That's it. But I'm concerned that we're too good. And when we're good, we will get out there, and just like we did with striped bass when it was crazy, we will knock the crap out of them things. And every recreational guy that can sling a bucktail is out there doing it. And if they can't, they're chumming, and it's just so good.
Yeah, we've heard of them. Same thing with striped bass. Yeah.
Yeah. So we can get them, and so we are getting them, and so far the fishing looks, it is, it's great, but the numbers are going to be astronomical because it's so good, and so that's a concern.
Skip.
The MRIP numbers, the old MRIP, were really high, so everybody's hoping the new MRIP is going to be more to what it is, and now the new MRIP is even worse than the old MRIP. So that's where I think something has to be done with that, because yes, there you can walk on them on the ocean front. I mean, I'm out there every day just running the cruise boat, and I've seen more groups of cobia on the ocean front this year, and this was in May when the weather was good, and you know, it's because there are more of them every year. I mean, they're still catching fish in Carolina.
Do you have any reason or any explanation for why the MRIP numbers and VMRC numbers are a tenfold difference? Are we not participating in our website attachment?
Want to comment on that?
Well, I mean, the reporting rates, they're right there. So reporting rate for the private sector is 62%. For the charters, 84%. If we were to expand those to 100% for both modes, you know, it's not close to MRIP. You know, everyone that's supposed to be, you know, recreationally participating in the cobia fishery is supposed to have a permit, but we still hear about reports of people that are still not aware that they needed a cobia permit. So I think this is still in the early stages, and we need to do maybe some more outreach and let people know that need a permit, and reporting will be important.
Do you have a plan for that outreach?
Well, we started, you know, using more social media. Like we put reminders on Facebook. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that the Marine Police have been there again out there every day boarding boats. So I think after this year, no one will have an excuse why they don't have, because they've all been out there this spring, this May and now, and the Marine Police are out there, and they're on them, and I talk to them just about every day when they're in there at the marina, and they're finding fewer and fewer that don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So after this year, that might curtail that end of it. And that's, I think that's why the VMRC numbers are, I think those are the numbers that's being caught and not the MRIP numbers.
So part of the outreach, which Pat explained earlier, this is the starting point where if you don't report after 21 days, we don't want to see you apply next year. You won't be able to if you don't report. That's part of the outreach there. The other thing on your question, and Skip just talked about it, is remember that cobia may not be a rare occurrence in our waters, but as far as MRIP goes, it's a rare occurrence to get the samples. And that's always been the problem, but yet we are, I don't want to say stuck, but I mean, we have to use MRIP. That's what we're going to end up using. So there has to be a situation where we get that reporting rate up a little higher than that, and then we have a case to take to use the data. It's been done before. Maryland did it with striped bass. Years ago, they said that the MRS, when we had MRS, that the MRS was not active for their charter fishery. They used logbooks. ASMFC accepted it. So now that we're in the ASMFC arena, as opposed to the federal arena, at least we have something we can negotiate with. So two different types of data. This is like census data. This is very similar to the commercial mandatory reporting. It's just not high enough reporting rate. And the MRIP is, you know what MRIP's about. It's a survey of effort. It's a survey of the catch rate thrown together into what Lewis calls the black box. And out comes your estimate.
And it's a shame that Virginia can't, there again, be the poster child for something, because VMRC and their surveying are doing such a great job. Jeff and those girls are down there every day. And, I mean, not just Armory, the boat ramps, Fisherman's Wharf, Ken sees them down there at Rockwell. I mean, they're really doing a real good job on the survey. And it's a shame, you know, Virginia can't step out and say, you know, we're going to use our numbers.
Well, we've won some small battles. I mean, we won a battle a couple of years ago with the, when they were doing the average weight. The numbers, the average weight per fish that NIFS had was, we just didn't think it was true, and they actually accepted our values.
Mm-hmm.
Because we had so many samples.
Yeah.
Wes, did you have a suggestion or a viewpoint?
Fact remains that MRIP and MRFIS, when they were running that, on species that are seldom intercepted at the dock, it's real easy for it to get overestimated. Mm-hmm. I can remember a couple years ago we were talking about cobia, and there was a three-week period where there was one fish intercepted, and it was expanded out to a huge number of fish. And it's because it happened to be a time of year when a lot of people fish. It also gets problems with geographic bias, which I hope staff, when they're looking at their survey, is working on that. For example, striped bass, and the year I looked at it, 90% of the intercepts were south of Back River for the wave six. And it's like, well, what happened to everybody up on the wrap and all that?
Ernie has a comment.
When you look at these numbers and you look at the recreational survey, if you underestimated the number of permittees by 100% and it was twice as many as what it is, and every single person went fishing, they still have to catch 20 apiece in a year. The likelihood of that is, I don't believe it exists. And cobia I've seen more this year than I've seen in my life. They're from like that up. Any size you want, because we're
catch them in bluefish net, that catch a bluefish that big. So there's no way in the world that his numbers can be anywhere near trustworthy. I mean, you know, I don't know if 27,000 is right, but I certainly know that 275,000 is wrong.
It's a pretty big range.
Yes, sir.
Jeff?
Okay, just a minute. Yeah, please, come on up and repeat your name again.
Just a question for education, please. I belong to a number of different angling clubs, and one of our clubs, we take veterans from the VA out to peer events monthly. And I noticed when we take them to Buck Row, there's just tons of people that are fishing for cobia off the end of that pier and catching them. And this past weekend, another angling club I belong to, we do an event at Ocean View. And I witnessed a guy pulling in a 42-inch cobia in the middle of the pier. And he had a ton of help with the fish net. And he caught him on a bottom rig. And the question I have is, do the pier catches fall into collection of data?
In MRAP? Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yes. It's one of the modes.
Mike?
Is there a VIM study on the mortality rate?
They have a tagging study they're doing now.
Pardon me? I participated in a data workshop, and I was the lead for the discard mortality group, and it was 5%. So we evaluated, I think, up to 8 different studies. DIMS was one.
Was that done, and what was the water temperature that was done in?
It was done, so primarily in Virginia, it was done, you know, when they arrived, I think in May, all throughout the summer, so it could vary.
Just as a point, I have a couple friends that have hook and line licenses that fish 5 or 6 days a week at York Spit.
Mm-hmm.
They keep 4 fish a day. They average 24 fish they catch to keep 4. So there is, and some of that is high grading, just to point that out. Also, I attended last month's ASMFC meeting, and I had the great fortune of being invited to the social hour the evening before. And I had dinner with the fishery managers from New York, Maryland, and New Jersey. And an interesting thing that I learned is that New Jersey pays NOAA to specifically do more data collection with more surveyors on specific fish, striped bass. Does VMRC do that?
From 1994 until 2015. So we had the license fund provided $60,000 a year to add on to striped bass, and we used to add on to both the effort and to the intercepts. And then what happened over time, we realized that there was a component that NIPS gave you for the intercepts, there was a component that ACCSP gave you, and then there was the add-ons from us. And as you went through the years, there was less with all three combined than there used to be with just NIPS. So we have done add-ons now, not specific to cobia that I'm aware of, because we do it by the wave. And we do it by the mode still, so probably a little bit. But, yes, that's not unusual, although some states have never added on. We've done that. But we're now down to finish it, the $60,000, because of economy and because the recreational license fund, the monies that go to projects are much less than they were 10 years ago. It's only $10,000 that we spend. So,
you know, thinking back, looking at the unsureness of the statistics from your surveys as well as NMRIP, you know, the way to resolve this is to go to a tagging program for recreational and commercial, and have the commercial recreational licenses, the permits, pay for those number of tags, and then you'll know exactly how many tags were issued. And then you can determine how many number of fish. It's pretty easy. It's the same, but it's not the ITQ
which is measuring pounds and quota. It's just count and tax, like the Potomac does. And then another question. I was at Obier's today selling some catfish, like I do pretty often, and I noticed quite a few of these 100-pound packing boxes. Usually have 125 pounds of fish in them. These had cobia in them. So how are, where are they from? Pound nets? Can cobia be kept in pound nets, and how are they tracked?
They have, if they catch it commercially, they have to report it.
Sure. They came from Reedville, I know that.
They're legally bound to report it.
I understand. So how many can be caught in a pound net?
Two per
license holder.
Per pound net license holder?
Anyone. Two.
So they have to have a strike, they have to have a cobia permit?
No, that's recreational.
No.
Okay.
Commercial fisherman registration license allows you to have two.
But then there's a vessel limit that applies. Is that 4 now or?
It's still six commercially.
So there's a six fish vessel limit, and if you're on a pound net and you've got two boats on the pound net, they still do two boats or one boat?
No, mine is one.
Okay, so there's a six fish vessel limit additionally.
So is anything
can have three licensed commercial fishermen on the boat, and they
can have six
fish. They could have six licensed commercial fishermen on the boat and still keep six fish.
So is any consideration being given to a tagging program?
Perhaps for strike bass, which you'll hear later, but not yet for cobia. One, you know, because we can only accommodate one system at a time. Takes personnel, if that's going to go over that. I mean, that's what we're gearing up for the recreational strike bass in its very early stages right now. So certainly that'll give us a lot of information about how to conduct such a tagging.
Because that certainly would be a coastwide poster example
it would be,
of fishery management.
There's some logistics with it, but it's a good idea.
The challenge with a recreational tagging system and using it for counting is everybody who thinks they might be able to catch a fish will have to have, or might accidentally catch a fish, mm-hmm. which is the only way I'm going to catch a cobia. It's going to have to have tags in their on their vessel with them, so they can tag the fish and be legal as soon as they get the fish. So that's going to inflate the number of tags that are out there. And how are you going to count the number that actually went into fish, other than a permitting system and reporting, where we do not have in the recreational fishery a check and balance of being able to go to the buyers and survey the buyers for what they've received. As compared to what the commercial fishermen,
we'd have to have some kind of program where those unused tags are returned the next year, or you don't get a permit.
I lost them.
You don't get a permit.
Yeah.
Then.
Could you do a check station?
Yeah.
Where they carry the fish to have them tagged like you did?
Yeah.
Well, with deer, you still put your own tag in the ear.
Sure.
But then you have to take it to a check station.
This will be a nightmare. How many tags do you, like me, I caught three this year. That's big enough to keep. But I'd have to have tags every year because I don't know if I'm going to catch any or not.
Right.
Everybody be in the same situation. So mm-hmm. you have 10,000 tags out and legally to land maybe 2,000 fish. So I don't have a tag system. You know, this isn't a million-pound quota like striped bass. Talking, what's it going to be, maybe 20,000 pounds, 25,000 pounds.
Commercially?
For Virginia,
yeah.
Commercial. I mean, it's going to be nothing. We're talking probably about 5% left. But you're going to have to issue 10,000 tags. And then, you know, the system we got for the small number it is working fine. I can't imagine why you would want to put the commercial fishermen and most especially staff in position that they'd have to track something. In the 20,000 pound and have to dedicate a staff personnel just for cobia fishing for the first 4 months.
Mr. Lightfoot, you were talking about recreational, or were you talking recreational and commercial? Both. Okay.
If you do one, do both.
Yeah. Well, just because of the size of recreational versus commercial, I mean, it's.
But I
see the point, though.
Yes, that's it. Any more? What's next?
Strike bass.
Well, we did strike.
Question.
The one commissioner's statement, were you suggesting that the boxes you saw that contained over 100 pounds of cobia that were from Reedville may have been commercially caught?
Yes.
Okay.
That was the only, I mean, okay. OB or seafood, it's commercial. No, there were three in each box.
Charts that wasn't in the PID for cobia?
That's his PID.
Was there anything in your charts that wasn't in the cobia PID?
No.
You got,
one
more?
Thank you.
The only thing would be that one table that Alex put that last one that was just something.
Thank you.
Is there another one or not?
Yep.
I know. I don't want to take it.
You got it. I got one more.
All right. My name is Alex Aspinwall, and today I will be giving you an update on the ASMSC process to develop a DEDM 6 by fall of 2019. So ASMSC met on April 30th, 2019. The ASMSC board initiated an addendum following the results of the 2018 benchmark stock assessment that showed that the fishery was overfishing and overfished. This addendum would specifically address the overfishing status to reduce the fishing mortality in 2017 down to the target in 2020. And in doing so, they tasked the PDT to develop options that would achieve that reduction. The PDT will be developing minimum sizes for both the coast and the Chesapeake Bay. They'll be also exploring the use of slot limits, eliminating the harvest of fish that were 40 inches or greater, so no harvest of large fish. Also looking at mandatory circle hooks to get at lowering discard mortality. They will also be using seasonal closures as a conservation equivalency tool. Under ASMSC, conservation equivalency is always an option. And they'll also be looking at reductions for both the recreational and the commercial fish. Commercial sector, either as an equal reduction or a proportional reduction. If it's an equal reduction, it's an 18% reduction for both commercial and recreational. If it's a proportional approach, it would require 1.8% reduction from the commercial fishery and a 20% reduction for the recreational fishery. And that's based on the removals that came from the recreational fishery and the commercial fishery in 2017. So the removals in 2017 is approximately 90% that makes up the recreational fishery, while 10% of the removals in striped bass in 2017 come from the commercial fishery. And that's how they would go about using that approach. This is the timeline. So right now, the PDT, we're developing the addendum. That should be final in July. The board will meet in August. They will minimize those options in the addendum. It will go out for public comment anywhere from August to September, and then there will be final action by the ASMSC board in October. BMRC will likely request a public hearing in October, either following that meeting, and then we'll have a public hearing in December. We typically don't have commission meetings in November since it falls over the holiday. So there should be plenty of time for public comment for us to, you know, discuss any concerns you may have about the addendum. So next I'm going to talk about the recreational conservation measures. The TC has indicated that 2017 will be the reference year that we use to show what reductions will be from. It's the last year in assessment. It's also the year that the fishery is evaluated based on what those removals were and how they impacted the reference points in that year. So the first option is a one fish possession limit from October 4th to December 31st. This is our Chesapeake Bay fall season. We would also, you know, we wouldn't have any changes to the season or the size limit. However, we would adjust the Chesapeake Bay spring season to June 1st to June 15th. Right now, the Chesapeake Bay season is May 16th to June 15th. So together, those options would equal an 18.66% reduction, which would meet that requirement. This option is fairly straightforward. It's going from two fish possession limit to one fish in the fall season, and we're taking 2 weeks out of the Chesapeake Bay spring season, and the two together equal just above an 18% reduction. The second recreational option that we put together is increasing the minimum size limit. So right now in the Chesapeake Bay, the minimum size limit is 20 inches. We are asking that an increase in the size limit by 2 inches, so 22 inches in the Chesapeake Bay, would actually result in a 17.9% reduction. We wouldn't change anything to the season. The session limit would still be the same. And you'll notice there's a little asterisk next to the 17.9% reduction, and that's because it doesn't quite meet the 18% reduction, but in 2019, when we closed the spring trophy season, that reduction in itself, and on top of a 22-inch minimum size limit, would achieve at least an 18% reduction. And therefore, this was an option that would actually meet that requirement. And you can see a 21-inch size limit in itself wouldn't quite meet that 18% reduction, and going up to 23 inches would achieve more than were being asked by ASMSC. The third recreational option that we're including is the only open recreational season would be November 17th through December 31st. So our recreational fishery for striped bass, 85% of the harvest primarily occurs in Wave 6, and it has been in recent years. And if we were to break that down even further, majority of the harvest would probably occur in December. So if we were to adjust the season starting from the very beginning and taking days from the early parts of Wave 3 through Wave 5, we would meet an 18% reduction by starting on November 17th and running that through the end of the season. And so that table you see in front of you, what that shows is if we were to close all days in Wave 3, that would give us about a 4.1% reduction. If we close all days in Wave 3 and all days in Wave 5, 28 days, that would give us a 7.4% reduction. If we were to close all days in Wave 3, Wave 5, and 16 days in Wave 6, which would start the season on November 17th, that would give us an 18% reduction. And then the next option you'll see what I'm doing is I'm taking it from the tail end of the season rather from the beginning, which isn't quite as much of a reduction in terms of days that we would have to give up. So this would be adjusting Chesapeake Bay fall season by removing 27 days from December. Again, possession limit would stay the same. No changes to the minimum size limit. We would not make any changes to the Chesapeake Bay spring season. But the fall season would start on October 4th, and it would end on December 4th. This table is slightly different from the one you saw before. It just shows what that reduction would look like with closures in these wave periods. So wave 6 alone, 27 days, would result in an 18.4% reduction. Wave 5 and wave 3 can be open. It's just looking at the reduction specific to that wave in itself. So next I'll be talking a little bit about recreational tagging. I'll be talking about a few other options too. They're all geared at, you know, they can all be used to augment the recreational options as conservation efforts for large fish. Not all of them can quantitatively be measured, but they specifically would target the reduction in harvest of some of the larger fish. So the problem, this would only be one fish per angler per year, 36 inches or greater. Unfortunately, MRIP, the data that we use to show savings with, isn't specific to the individual. So you can't go back and say, oh, you know, that was John and he caught the fish on this date, and then, oh, this was John and he caught this fish on this date. So we can't estimate what those savings were, but we believe that especially those fishermen that are very good at what they're doing are probably catching, you know, more than one 36-inch fish or greater. And so this would implement a tagging system that could be tacked on to the other recreational options that we've already gone over. We wouldn't necessarily get any savings from it, but we know, not on paper, that there likely would be savings associated with this, and it would protect some of those larger spawning size fish, which is part of the stock assessment, not addressing this addendum, but probably will be later in the amendment. The next one is a vessel limit. So you are familiar with the vessel limit like we have for our cobia fishery, where one fish of a certain size is only allowed per vessel. Again, this can be tacked on to the other options that we discussed. When I looked at the trip level data through MRIP, there were no trips that had more than one 36-inch fish on board that was interviewed. Staff believes that there are probably multiple trips, specifically in the month of December, that probably catch more than one 36-inch fish and bring it home.
I would doubt anybody's coming back with less than that.
Nobody's coming back with less than that.
All right, Mike.
Just a comment. You can certainly see charter boat Facebook pages with more than that.
That's what we're kind of referring to. We know that just from social media and angler reports that you know, it's highly likely that charter guys or people that know what they're doing are catching and bring home more than one 36-inch
fish. Very,
very. When you have a party size likely. More than one.
Most likely.
It's beyond. It's
yes, right.
All right.
So what I'm saying is we can't capture that through MRIP because, you know, maybe that fish wasn't intercepted, but we know that there would be savings associated with this, and it would be
but
more towards
having a requirement to have a tag in each one of those recreationally over 36 inches gives you accountability.
Exactly, and that's
I'll
why
always
we
be on the
that.
Accountability because we live with that on the commercial side.
Yep, and that's why we had the tagging system as an option. The next is a circle hook provision. So a circle hook provision will be included in the addendum. Likely it will be either something that's put forth as a conservation effort because it's very difficult to quantify, it's difficult to enforce. So if a law enforcement officer were to stop someone and they would actually have to probably see them in the act of catching that fish and seeing if they had a circle hook, because if there was a rod on board with a circle hook and there were fish in the box, it would, you know, they technically could have caught it using that gear. So using a recreational survey that Maryland conducted in the Chesapeake Bay, they asked anglers how many anglers are using artificial versus live bait, and they did it by wave period. If we were to apply that to our releases, our recreational releases, just releases alone, in terms of the removal, savings and removals, it could be up to 10%. But Tom Powers had brought up to us, and we realized that I think Maryland's fishery for striped bass operates a little bit differently than ours in terms of what they're using. I think our recreational anglers probably catch and release more fish using artificial lures, except maybe during the month of December when they're eeling. So we believe it's probably not as high as 10%. When I look at their artificial versus live or dead bait by weight period, I see some estimates that are as high as 40% or 50% that are using bait. We just don't feel that reflects really how our fishermen operate in Virginia.
Just a comment. With using a circle hook, live baiting, which I've done, you have to let the fish, with the live bait, you have to let the fish swallow the bait before you set the hook. So with circle hooks, that's a little different because it's going to be gut hooked when you let it swallow the bait.
Yeah, so we understand that, and we know that the idea behind a circle hook and the hooking mortality with the circle hook is lower. It's 5% rather than 9%. And so the idea is that those releases would be applied to this lower hooking mortality, and therefore fewer fish would die after being released. So we realize that that's how Circle Hook operates, but Circle Hook is designed to not to get away from being gut hooked and cook them in the corner of the mouth as pressure is being applied. So we don't think it's quite a 10%, and I think the addendum is not going to use these towards savings, but more as a conservation effort that would be applied when using live bait for the coastal fishery or to the bay.
Excuse me. Are you going to specify which type of circle hook, whether it be offset or non-offset?
They likely will do something in the addendum, yeah.
To his point, on gut hooking with a circle hook, you're going to gut hook them if it is an offset hook. You're not going to gut hook them if it is a non-offset hook.
Right. So it would be a non-offset circle hook.
Okay. Alex, one more question, if I may, Mr. Chairman. Do you expect any other state to undertake any of these ancillary provisions over and above what is going to be specified, or will this be unilateral to Virginia?
No, I think there's been a lot of interest for circle hooks, not just in Maryland and, you know, what we talked about here in Virginia. I think there's been a handful of other states that are wanting to jump on board, and that's why it was included in the motion as
Maryland's
well.
Maryland's not a good example to cite.
Maine has it. New Hampshire's thinking about it. Massachusetts is definitely has been reviewing it. With Massachusetts, though, they don't expect, at least for now, to go to the four higher, but they will go to the angling groups. At the ASMSC meeting, it was talked about. Was talked about there, and you know, I think the conclusion was, well, we can't really show any of these savings that we're all trying to show, but we can help the fishery out. So that's the way it stands right now.
Thank you.
Can you wait till after he's finished? Thank you.
So next we'll be talking about the commercial fishery, and as Rob had talked about earlier, it's for the commercial fishery, what's on the table right now are quota reductions. Whether that's an equal reduction or a proportional reduction, that's up to the board. But for the commercial fishery, we're looking at a quota reduction likely. So the current restrictions, I've listed those here, that pertain to Virginia's commercial fishery is we have a 6-inch maximum nest size from March 26th to June 15th, and we also have a 28-inch maximum size limit during that period. The minimum size is 18 inches, and that's from January 16th to December 31st. There is no maximum mess size in the Chesapeake Bay except what during that time period, March 26th to June 15th, and there currently is no maximum mess size requirement on the ocean. So it's, you know, moving forward, they've really just been moving forward with the quota at this time. When we look at when we compare the removal from the commercial and the recreational fishery, remember earlier I said that 90% came from the recreational fishery, 10% came from the commercial fishery. It's a little different in Virginia. Recreational dead discards and with harvest is about 391,000 fish. Virginia commercial removals in 2017, it's about 160,718 fish, so that about 41% of the commercial removals come from Virginia, are in Virginia. That's what percentage makes up the entire removals in Virginia, while 59% come from the recreational fishery. So it's still weighted a little bit more towards the recreational fishery, but it's certainly not a 90-10% proportion.
On this?
Yeah. Does the commercial include dead discards?
Yes.
If so, does it include it from other fisheries? For instance, the white perch fishery is historically, and I'm not saying it happens in Virginia, but there are studies in Maryland, I mean not in Maryland, North Carolina, that show that that the white perch fishery has an excessive dead discards of striped bass. Now they're not striped bass that are big enough to keep.
Right.
But they are, I mean, and the numbers I've heard are like 7 to 10 to 1 striped bass dead discards compared to white perch. Now, they did find ways that you could fish for them where you didn't have that high of a bycatch mortality, but if you're counting
dead recreational fish, you need to count across the fisheries and not just put a number based on the harvest of striped bass commercially. Because my opinion is commercial fishermen who are fishing for striped bass with a proper net size don't have many dead discards because they want to keep them or call their buddies up to put their tags in them.
The commercial dead discards are specific to the striped bass fishery. Not
so that is a erroneous approach to analyzing the data. I'm sorry.
Well, it's how it's analyzed in the stock assessment. So that's
it's an erroneous approach when you're trying to say we're comparing what the recreational commercial sectors in Virginia are doing for striped bass.
Okay. And at that point, that's really all I have for the update on the addendum. If anyone has any questions about stock assessment, I can go through the stock assessment, what that looked like. But we've reviewed that in the last three meetings, and I'd be happy to address any questions you have about those options as well.
Thank you. Are we going to discuss commercial quota cuts or methods to do a conservation equivalency? I mean, you know, they're originally, this page here was like 13 or 11 options for recreational, and then we had a page that was four or five options for commercial. What happened to that?
Right. So what happened was a lot of those recreational options didn't achieve. At the time, we didn't know what the reduction was necessary to achieve the target. So we had a list of options, and after further reviewing those options, not everything could be combined together, and not all of them would achieve the reduction. So we wanted to bring forward options that would not only achieve what ASMSC is asking for us, but are options that we can receive feedback from you and kind of guide some decisions.
Are you saying that we've abandoned any conservation equivalency changes for the commercial side and just assumed an 18% cut?
At this point, the addendum will be just looking at quota.
We didn't abandon. We were informed that what we had been trying to do, which is get measures that could increase the spawning potential and lower the fishing mortality rate, that the technical committee was not considering those. They want to see fish, whether they're alive from the harvest or whether they're dead discards. It's all about fish. My expectation is that the shot at conservation equivalency comes when the ASMSC is coaxed, and they've already started coaxing the ASMSC.
Okay, what was the word?
Coaxed into an amendment.
Okay, all right.
This is an addendum. So what the board wants is they want it nice and neat, nice and clean. It'll take an amendment to bring forward the kind of things that we started out trying to do. So that's what happened. And it's within the last week, 7 days, 8 days, something like that, with the technical committee. So
is an 18% cut imminent?
We don't know. We don't know because the board has to decide between those two options. And then the other board, BMRC board, has to decide as well. So, too early. Same thing I told Wes Lowe, about an hour ago. It's too early to know what's going on.
And that would provide a dilemma, and I'll see if I can explain it. If other states would adopt, I'll rephrase it, when the large glut of the big glut for the 2 or 3 week period in March of big fish hit us, there's only a limited number of states can take that large number of big fish over 36 inches. If Massachusetts, New York already has a New York sized fish, they won't take anything over 36. If Massachusetts and other states adopt a similar thing, there won't be a market for these large fish in that 2 to 3 week period. And that comes, I'm quoting that, from Stuart Obeer at Obeer Seafood, that he already has a problem moving so many big fish. And if the other states won't buy them, where will they go? So, that's an interesting dilemma.
Yeah, the first step is the ASMSC. So All we know, there are 5 states out of 13 boats. So there are 5 boats out of 13 that don't have a commercial fishery to begin with. And then we know there's certainly issues of parity for both fisheries. Virginia probably comes closest to not a 50-50 split. I think what Alex showed you was in the 40s, low 40s for commercial, and in the 59 for recreation. So that's why it's a dilemma that's going to last. But the first step has to be the ASMSC. And I know anyone who was there at the April meeting, it took, you know, like 15 minutes for someone to figure out what proportional meant at the ASMSC. You know, they kept on, you know, with Maryland, they kept on doing it, you know, without saying what it was. But so that's what we have to see first, and that's the best that I know of right now.
So if we just have an 18% cut and don't have any restrictions on large fish, and the other states won't accept the big fish, then we have a dilemma of the buyers not being able to move these fish over 36 inches. And I mean, they all, the price for those already goes down to $1.75 a pound for a week or two period. And if Obeer says, don't bring me any more big fish because I don't have a buyer for them, so the waterman's choice is, what, throw them, I mean, let them throw them over, I mean, let them float away and rot? What do you do?
Mm-hmm. That'll regulate itself. If your buyer can't buy them, then you'll be forced to catch smaller fish, but I don't have a problem moving large fish, so I don't understand.
I'm just quoting what Stanley.
I don't understand where Stuart's coming from. I've never had a problem moving them.
Ernie?
50 states in the union, one that I know is about 38 inch maximum. The other 49, you can sell them to. So some of my fish originally used to, when George would go to Chicago, I don't know where all his go. They go to a lot of places besides New York, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and Virginia. I don't know where he's getting these ideas from, because every state, with the exception of us with the Chesapeake Bay, harvests fish that are that big. They have to. Massachusetts has a large commercial quota. Their smallest fish they can keep is 34 inches. So there's plenty of places to sell them. I mean, you know, I just feel like somebody's misinformed you, or you misread information, or something, because there's plenty of market for big fish. It's very limited market for small fish. A lot of places do not take small fish. New York will not take a small fish. That's the biggest fish market on the East Coast. They won't take anything under 28 is a small fish they take. So that's the biggest market on the coast. They will not buy the fish if you're harvesting. They have to be sold locally. So, you know, I don't know why we're in this big fish, small fish business, because that's not where we are.
All right.
I think he's got it a little bit confused. The problem this year was that so many big fish came in, the market just dropped. That was the problem. It wasn't if they couldn't sell them, the market was flooded. Nobody wanted them. Even if they could buy them, they didn't want them. They had too many fish.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the problem we run into. We were catching small fish. We didn't have any problem getting rid of that. But a lot of our buyers, they were freezing big fish, just hoping that later on they could sell them.
Okay.
I think that's what the problem is, really. It's too many fish.
At one
time. Now y'all want to cut some more.
The lowest I got was $4 a pound for my big ones. I got $4.50 for almost all of them, but I did get $4 one time.
All right. We have one comment from the audience. Yes, ma'am. Please.
Teresa Vaughn. Okay, I'm just going to go back on the circle hooks. That's going to be hard to enforce. I'm out in the family. I'm going out in the boat catching fish, and I might not be targeting striped bass. I don't have a circle hook. I just got a regular hook. So, I don't know. Just something to think about.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that just goes to the enforcement. It's difficult to enforce.
Would you mind going back to the very first one when it was motions that they made at agency, so just for a second for me?
Yeah, sure.
Tom?
I would request that somehow, and I don't know if it's now or if it's in September that you do it, that we go back and we look at the slot no-take limit. That was a very popular way to do a reduction and try to get days back using some method like that. And that actually, in my opinion, really does a lot to saving the spawning stuff on the recreational side. On the commercial side...
Back to your point.
What?
This is the 28 to 36 now.
Okay, yeah, there's a slot no-take that you... Somebody can decide what that side is. We can debate it.
The comment before was to extend that back up into the season because what we showed didn't start back in the season.
Right. So my comment from before was that, but what I'm looking at now, you don't have any option that has a slot no take in it at all. And if we had a slot no take for the entire fall season, then that could go a long ways towards.
Yeah. I had addressed exactly that. It just didn't actually make it to some of these options that we've gone over today. So a no-take slot limit from 28 to 36 inches from October 4th pushed back through December 31st would be about 3.67% reduction. So we're aiming for 18, at least 18. So that would have to be coupled with something else.
But if you couple that with a closure in early, for example, a closure in early December, that may get us to December 15th. You know, something along those lines could be a.
It would have to be something pretty significant. Yeah, yeah.
But and you know, some years December 15th, the fishery is done.
Yeah, it could be weather dependent too.
Some, a lot of years it's not, but.
Lately, that's been kind of more than.
Anyway, just please keep options like that on the table.
Okay, yeah, we'll explore the no-take slots in combination with maybe season adjustments or possession limits or something else to get
so
to that.
So this bottom
reduction.
Option here, that has to come out of ASMSC before it's even an option for us to consider?
ASMSC would discuss. The board would vote to move down the proportional approach.
Okay, right now that's just one of the options.
That's just one of the two approaches, yes.
Okay.
I have another option or comment from the audience, please.
I'm Mike Avery. I just have two questions. When I see 18% cut, my question is 18% of what? Are we talking about 18% of historical catch allocation? Catches like our catch in Virginia is like 3%, Maryland's 46%. Right. If you cut 17% of 3%, that's significant. 17% right. of 46% is not as significant.
So the 18% refers to a reduction in removals, and when I say removals, I'm talking about total harvest and dead discard. So ASMSC put together a projection analysis that showed what would the removals level need to be in 2020 to achieve. To reduce the F where it is right now in 2017 to the target. And they came up with what an ideal removals estimate would be, and that was 18%.
Of what?
Of the removals in 2017.
Based on historical landings by state?
Based on the removals by state in 2017.
So my point is that our historical catch is like 3% of the coastwide catch as compared to Maryland's 46%. So 18% to us is significant, 18% to Maryland is not nearly as significant. So I'm saying you're starting out with an unfair system of 18%.
Right, but it will be applied, so 17% to us will equal some sort of removal number, and then it will be much larger for Maryland, who harvests or removes much more fish. So it's going to be applied evenly to every state, regardless of what their how their fishery operates.
All right, let's say 100 fish, right? Okay, so Maryland catches 46 fish. 18% of those 46 fish is not that significant, but 18% to three fish is pretty significant.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm just...
I understand where you're coming from.
All right, second question is, are there any plans by staff to implement any cuts for this fall season for 2019?
None that I know of right now.
Okay.
Tom?
So one of the things to make
make me feel better about what you were just talking about, is Maryland has, and Massachusetts is a prime example, much higher dead discards. Now they're counting dead discards as part of what we have, what has to be reduced. So us having kind of a 50-50 fishery as far as the recreational is concerned, about half of what we, about the amount we harvest is also dead discards, to hold your thumb up.
Usually it's like a one-to-one ratio.
Yeah, it's one-to-one. Whereas in Massachusetts, historically, it was 10 dead fish for every one you kept. So they've still got to do an 18% reduction on all of that. And they can't do it by just changing limits because, or sizes, because they're still going to have all those dead discards. They've got to do closed seasons to meet that. We, for example, can do our total reduction just by increasing the minimum size and still have almost our entire fishery as far as days to fish. So we're in better shape than we could be. Because they're counting dead discards now. It's not like it used to be 5 years ago where they didn't count dead discards.
I showed a table to the commission when we went through the spring trophy. And I've always known that Virginia's low on the discards, period, compared to the other states. We usually rank 7th, 8th. 1 year we were 5th only because other states were low too. But in general, we're in the lower echelon for discards. The season is going to be off the table for the coast. I mean, they've made that clear in the addendum. They think it's too complicated because there are so many different seasons. And Bob Beal said that. And I said, well, wait a minute. From 1999 until 2013, for summer flounder, every year we had to do size, bag, and season. So how can it be more complicated for striped bass? But that's because, you know, there's some big clout in other places, quite frankly, and you're going to need an amendment to take care of that. And I think we're going to need an amendment because, you know, if you raise the size limit again in the bay and you raise the coastal size limit to 35 inches, which is what the prevailing proposal is, from 28 to 35. So we, not necessarily, but imagine Maryland already with a lot of dead discards. We'll have more dead discards. We've got these year classes that push through, starting a little teeny bit at age 4, but all the way by age 8. And a lot of those fish, when they're on the coast, they're not size enough to be taken by 28 right now, let alone 35 inches. So it's a situation that's going to be talked about quite a bit, because everyone said at the February meeting at the board, God, we can't believe we have all these dead discards. We have got to work on that. Well, you don't work on that by changing the size limits like that. So, you know, this is, you're in for the long game here. You really are. I mean, you know, the only good thing is there's a fairly good, not tremendous, but fairly good 2014-2015 year classes. Fairly good, but not like you're familiar with, and I can name them all, but let's just start with 2011, the last really big year class. So this is going to be go on and on. And, you know, the next assessment is 2021 probably. And the MRIP situation, what we all have to watch with MRIP is the trend we see now. And I like that our commission members are here, because the trend analysis that Dr. Neal mentioned, we have to watch that when we get through 2019. Was it just a one-year situation that you saw that boost everywhere, or are we going to see it repeated? So there's so much variability that I don't know. I mean, I think that this is just the first stop here. An amendment probably would have been better, but I think a lot of states have to answer to the public, rightfully so, that they couldn't wait 2 years for an amendment to become final. So what I'd like to say is, if you have suggestions, like Tom had his suggestion
on the no-take slot, maybe coupled with something else, provide them to Jeff. Jeff will send them to us. Anything you want to try out, we'll try out. And then from now until after the August meeting of the board, we're not going to meet. You know, we've had four meetings. The purpose tonight was to show mainly the recreational options that achieved an 18% reduction. So we'll come back after the ASMFC. If you have a chance to go up there, go up there, just because I think it's going to be, half the meeting is going to be pretty confusing, because the questions that you have, every state has. It'll iron out. You know, it'll be okay. But the result is that we're hoping that this, just let's play with the size limit, isn't something that, you know, raise the minimum size a little bit, raise the minimum size a lot on the coast. I don't think that'll help us out. And so I hope you can have other comments to Jeff. We will make this available to everyone, the PowerPoint, tomorrow, and you can go through it. And then let's meet again after early August.
Could you just explain that last bullet?
I can, yeah.
Yeah, I can too, but you do it because you're doing the presentation.
Sorry. So the proportional reduction is based on removals from the commercial and the recreational fishery in 2017. So 10% of those removals come from the commercial fishery.
Yeah,
coastwide. that is a 1.8% reduction would be necessary to apply that to So there's an 18% reduction in its entirety that needs to be achieved. Because 90% comes from the recreational, 10% comes from the commercial. 10% of that 18% reduction is a 1.8% reduction for the commercial fishery.
So does that mean my quota gets cut 1.8 or 18?
18%.
To get to the first step. The first step is what the ASMFC thinks of that.
If ASMFC were to say, this is an option of how we're going to do it, I believe the answer is, yes, your cut would be 1.8%.
Yes, sure.
And the recreational cut, instead of being 18%, would be 20%. That's what that says. And
Ernie? Interesting. When I bought my quota in 2010, it's now half.
This is the problem I have with the whole thing. It's giving me heartburn. You know, in 2015, we were all supposed to cut 25%.
What, for 2016 fishing year?
All the commercial achieved their 25% or more. None of the recreational did. Some of them increased by well over 100%, 200%. So now they're going to reduce 20% from a 200% increase, and you want us to take 18% more from our real decrease we already had.
Legally, you can't do it in Virginia if it goes through. Legally, you could not do it in federal waters. ASMFC is above all of it.
Before Rob got up and spoke, I've lit to him that it'll never happen on the coast. Have you ever been to ASMFC meetings? And I've been to quite a few of them. I chaired their wheat fish committee for a number of years. That was the biggest advisory committee they ever had, was the wheat fish. And I went to a lot of them. And on striped bass, most of the time the vote always come down the exact same way. We have no state to the south to help us. North Carolina is the end of it. So we pick up no southern states for votes. So it's always the north state against producer area. You know, they use us, I guess, for their spawning stock. They're not going to reduce anything. They've increased their harvest 200%. Nobody's even looking at that. And I think if I'm telling something wrong, Rob, you stand right up there and you correct me. You know, the numbers I got, and I asked you to distribute them, and I'm sure, and you did. I don't think we got them here, probably, and that's where they really need to be to discuss them. You know, we got our 25%. And I think to be fair, and the reduction needs to be from the 2015 numbers on the recreational side, which would close a lot of the fisheries in the Northeast and the state of Maryland, because they would be have to pay back. You know, we went over in a commercial ocean quota one time, 186 pounds or something. It was nothing. Whatever the number was, it was nothing. We had to pay it back over 2 years. And then a couple years ago, staff made a mistake and allocated, I forgot, 2,700 pounds to somebody. We had to pay that back. We had nothing to do with it. But it came out of us. It cost me $450. It cost every fisherman that much on a commercial ocean quota. It cost the buyers because they didn't have fish. So, you know, we've been paying back on the recreational side. Virginia is not a culprit in this. Their recreational catch is not on a, I don't think, very little. Maryland's has went through the ceiling. Maryland's is up several hundred percent. So now you're asking them to cut down 20% from a number that's three times what they were catching before they were supposed to have their original 25% reduction. And you know, it's basic fairness. I don't want to see that done on either side, recreation or commercial. And I think a lot of our problem is they're working all this new recreational survey information into the stock assessment. Striped bass are not in decline. The ocean has had plenty of bass. There have been plenty on the bay. I've been fishing for 50-some years. This is the first time in my life that I've ever seen rock that size in the ocean in May and June. You don't see it.
Scientists say they don't go
out. Because it's gone outside trying to catch bluefish, you can't get close to the beach because the small rock in 3.5, 3.75 inches, they're like 14 to 16 inches. It was just the amount of them you couldn't fish. You just had to quit. So I just think the stock, I've only ever seen two stock assessments this past, weak fish, when they said they were fully recovered. I was sitting in Arlington at a meeting. I think he was on the technical committee at the time. Jack Travelstead and I were sitting there, and the technical committee gave a presentation about the weak fish were recovered. And we were going to have all these 16 and 18 inch fish and stuff. And I looked at Jack Travelstead. I said, those fish don't weigh much because they're made out of paper. I said, they don't exist. They're on that piece of paper, and that's all they're going to weigh. And Tom told things right. They weren't there. You know, I can see trends. I don't see a downward trend in striped bass. I certainly see an upward trend because you've got so many small fish that's not accounted for. So, you know, I just, all these questions are going to be answered under oath somewhere, you know, because I'm definitely going to want a formal hearing. And I think it's going to go much further than that. You know, we've hit our 25%. If everybody had done their 25%, on the recreational side, most especially Maryland and the Northeast, we wouldn't be even talking about this. This wouldn't even be a discussion, because if they had reduced 25%, the stock would have been double what it is right now. So, you know, you're asking us, you're punishing me for somebody else's sin. So that's where we're on this. I'm just upset over the whole thing. We've already made our reduction. You know, if you're going to give me another 18%, take 43% away from the 2015 numbers, and that's what you got on the recreational side too, and then everybody's treated equally. And that's all I expect. If I get a 40% reduction, everybody should have a 40% reduction. It shouldn't just be on one sector because it's easy. You know, when this started, we were 15% of the fishery, and now we're 8. So the commercial has just been ratcheted back, and the recreational keeps going up. And the reason why is when the fish recovered, New York tried to get an increase over status quo, and it didn't get it. You know, Northeast would not vote for it. New York went with it. Virginia went with it. I think Maryland went with it. But the voters wasn't there because you got New England voting as a bloc. So that's where we're on this, and that's what I'm upset about the most is we're not getting treated fairly. And it says you can't discriminate against user groups. You can apply the theory that you're being forced to do it by someone else. But the only way you can really apply that theory is if you're trying to do something. If, you know, we see a load of motions made at AFMSC, even if they failed, nobody seconded them, that we're trying to do something, your side would have a very strong argument.
But when we're not trying to do anything, and we'll just keep doing the same thing over and over again, I just, you know, it's futile even to come to meetings. That's the reason you have nobody here anymore.
Doug Jenkins met with a lawyer who was one of the state's lawyers assigned to VMRC, who is now in private practice, to file a class action lawsuit against the state for exactly what you just said.
They're breaking the code of Virginia. The code of Virginia says you cannot, you know, and Rob and I had a discussion before on other things. When I was on the commission for a year, the people would come there and they would always say that, for example, straight backpack. He got a mod then, you're discriminating against me, and the law says you can't. No, the law says you can't discriminate between user groups when it comes time to allocate a resource. This is discriminating against user groups when it comes time to, you're making me reduce 41%, you're not on the other side.
Robert, did you have some?
Yeah, I tried to go. I actually had a meeting with Congressman Rob Whitman, and there was actually a video made of him and I standing there, and he asked me a couple of questions. What I told him was that this ASMFC is mainly northern states, and Virginia doesn't have anybody backing them. And if when fish come into Virginia waters, they should belong to the VMRC and Virginia fishermen. And he was all agreeing with me and all this stuff, but later on, I called his assistant, Joe, and I asked him, I said, what happened to that video? Nobody knows where the video went. But that's what I told him. I said, we shouldn't be, the northern states shouldn't be telling Virginia what we can do with our fish when they're in our waters. And he seemed to agree with it. His son is a commercial fisherman. And I don't understand why people can't understand that.
Yeah, well, I'm a walking history lesson, and I don't understand about Virginia backing, because the history is the commercial fishery had 211,000 pounds from 1990 to 94, got a bump up to 850,000 pounds in 95 when the ASMFC said, we won, the stock is recovered. 1996, we got another slug up to 1.3 million, and then we aligned with Maryland and the Potomac River Fishery Commission, and we had a very fair system from 1997 until 2013. When the ASMFC passed Addendum 4 that went into effect in 2015, they worked on 2014, go look at the record. I said, you have just destroyed Baywide cooperation, and you've dismantled the ability for the Bay to cooperate. And, you know, I don't believe in conspiracy theories, but it's kind of weird that Addendum 4 was a bust. I mean, for what happened, I mean, it just promoted more dead discards all over the place. And yet, you know, today we don't have that Baywide cooperation. We don't have that harvest control model. Now, really, the harvest control model was getting wobbly, but there's some smart people around. We could have probably got it on its feet if we hadn't had it taken away from us. But when they said, you take your cuts from 2012, which... In 8.5 hours, I had to repeat myself 3 different times to say, no, you can't take it from 2013. We already took a 14% reduction for the commercial fishery in 2013. You have to take it from 2012, which they did. And then they mistakenly took it from the recreational fishery in 2012 instead of 2013. But once that was done, I mean, that really set the stage for, you know, the inability for Virginia to have immediate allies in the Bay, because things were more balanced. Now, I know the stock, I don't think the stock is what it was, but a few good year classes coming along besides 2014-15, maybe we have something to look forward to. But in the meantime, you know, all of you are in this for a little while, to say the least. Addendum 4 could have lasted 1 year to 3 years max. So it should have been done in 2017. It's not quite done yet. But what you're saying is correct, that we went through many 9-7 votes against us, 9-7 votes against us. But certainly the backing from my old boss and from me, I feel like we have backed Virginia
It's just that you have 13 votes. And most of those, as someone just said a minute ago, aren't below North Carolina. They don't count. So it's, you know, it's tough to, and I don't mean it's tough that way. I mean, it's tough to watch all this happen. It's tough for you, if you're not watching it, to hear what has happened. So just my little sermon on the mount for the evening, but we're going to get back together right after August. I'll get in touch with Jeff, see his availability. We'll send a couple of dates probably this time so everyone has a chance to be here. I'm sure we'll have more of the public here. Everyone wants to make sure that we can not get caught by management issues and management measures that really don't help us or the other states. So, I mean, more later.
Is that it, Alex?
Yeah, that's all I have.
Any more new business or okay, an old business just for my education? Where do we stand on the fish towing? Whatever happened with that issue?
They changed the regulation. It took a couple of months, but it was finally decided for striped bass and cobia.
Okay.
What the committee started out with, but then it got moved into our regulatory review committee, which is a great committee, but they had some awkward moments, I think, as far as maybe adding on to it. But eventually came back to the commission. Lewis did a great job. Right past the token.
Okay. Any other new?
That one, is it possible to ask one more dry bass question?
Certainly.
And on all the analysis that you did you look at taking anything off the beginning and removing part of the time off the beginning of the fall season?
Yes, I did. I did.
November 17th.
Yeah. Let me see right here. Yeah. So, let's see. Okay, so this starts from the beginning of the season and
It would essentially remove everything in October up through November 17th. That's the answer I was looking for. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
And the spring.
Sorry, I missed that earlier. Thank you.
And we don't know yet what the date will be, so if there's then nothing else, then motion to adjourn. Second?
Second.
We're adjourned. Thank you, everybody.
I got a text from Wes, he left.